On Ideas, the 1988 Massey Lectures about Media, Propaganda and Democracy. A series of five talks concluding tonight, divided into 16 parts and including questions from a panel of distinguished Canadian journalists. The Massey Lectures, presenting original work commissioned by the CBC from leading figures in the arts and sciences, religion and politics, have been an annual event on CBC Radio for the past 27 years. The 1988 lectures are given by Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Professor Chomsky's internationally renowned work in the field of structural linguistics was this year awarded the prestigious Kyoto Prize, the Japanese version of the Nobel Prize, carrying a stipend of $380,000. Professor Chomsky holds 8 honorary degrees from universities around the world, and the current bibliography of his writing contains over 700 articles and 30 books. His political writing is presently focused on the function of the mass media as a propaganda system. "I don't want people to believe me," he says, "any more than they should believe the party line I'm criticizing, academic authority, the media, the overt state propagandists, or whatever. In talks and in print, I try to stress what I think is true, that with a little willingness to explore and use one's mind, it is possible to discover a good deal about the social and political world that is generally hidden. I feel I've achieved something if people are encouraged to take up this challenge and learn for themselves." The title of the 1988 Massey Lectures is Necessary Illusions. The phrase comes from the philosopher Reinhold Niebuhr, who concluded that ordinary people were hardly capable of understanding the world or behaving properly without being subjected to a set of what he called necessary illusions, what we'd call propaganda, constructed by the intellectual elites and conveyed by the mass media. The language of this system was parodied, or perhaps just described, by George Orwell as Newspeak. Noam Chomsky's lecture tonight, The Utility of Interpretations, is in two sections, followed by a discussion with the journalists' panel, and that's followed by some concluding remarks. The title, The Utility of Interpretations, comes from the French philosopher Pascal in his discussion of the casuists, whose task it is to conceal the truth with sophisticated argumentation and deceit. Pascal wrote about how the casuists reconcile the contradictions between their opinions and the dictates of Scripture. He records a conversation with a monk who explains that one of the ways we reconcile these contradictions is by the interpretation of some phrase. Thus, if the gospel says you should give alms of your superfluity, and the aim is to exempt the wealthy from the obligation of almsgiving, the matter is easily put to rights by giving an interpretation to the word superfluity, so that it will seldom happen that anyone actually has to follow the command of the gospel. Learned scholars will demonstrate that what men of the world lay up to improve their own circumstances or those of their relatives cannot really be termed superfluity, so the rich will seldom actually be obliged to give alms. There you see the utility of interpretations, Pascal's monk concludes. Concealing the truth by the interpretation of some phrase, by making words mean what is convenient for them to mean, is a project much in evidence in the contemporary elite media. The 1988 Massey Lectures by Noam Chomsky. Part 14. The Utility of Interpretations.
Last night, I discussed some of the modalities of thought control developed in democratic societies. The most effective device is the bounding of the thinkable, achieved by tolerating, even encouraging debate, though only within proper limits. But democratic systems also resort to cruder means, the method of interpretation of some phrase being a notable instrument. Thus, aggression and state terror in the Third World become defensive democracy and human rights, and democracy is successfully achieved when the government is safely in the hands of the rich men dwelling at peace within their habitations, as in Winston Churchill's prescription for world order. Under the proper interpretation of the phrase, it is indeed true that the yearning to see American-style democracy duplicated throughout the world has been a persistent theme in American foreign policy, as New York Times correspondent Neil Lewis declared. Accordingly, there is no contradiction when we yearn for democracy and independence for South Vietnam while demolishing the country to eradicate the National Liberation Front, then turning to the destruction of the politically organized Buddhists before permitting stage-managed elections. Casuistry even permits us to proceed on this course while recognizing that until they were compelled by U.S. terror to use counterforce to survive, the indigenous enemy insisted that its contest with the United States and its clients should be fought out at the political level, and that the use of massed military might was in itself illegitimate. I'm quoting U.S. government scholar Douglas Pike. Continuing to quote him, "Our rejection of politics in favor of military might is quite natural, because we recognized," as he says, "that the National Liberation Front was the only truly mass-based political party in South Vietnam. With the same reasoning, it was only proper for us to subvert the first and the last free election in the history of Laos because the wrong people won, to organize or support the overthrow of elected governments in Guatemala, Brazil, the Dominican Republic, the Philippines, Chile, and Nicaragua, to support or directly organize large-scale terror to bar the threat of democracy and independence in Central America in the 1980s, to take strong measures to ensure that the post-war world would return to proper hands, and much else, all in what we call our yearning for democracy. From the same perspective, one can understand why, in December 1965, the New York Times editors should praise Washington for having wisely stayed in the background during the recent upheavals in Indonesia. In these recent upheavals, the Indonesian military, as they say, had defused the country's political time bomb, the powerful Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI. They had done so by eliminating virtually all the top and second level leaders of the PKI in one or another matter, and incidentally, slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people, mostly landless peasants, while Washington wisely observed in silence, the editors choose to believe. This concomitant of a welcome victory for freedom is not mentioned, although the editors warn that the social conditions that enabled the PKI to organize 14 million people still persist. Similarly, it is natural that the New York Times should praise the government of the Shah of Iran, restored to power by the CIA, for what they call its long record of success in defeating subversion without suppressing democracy. The subversives, now thankfully suppressed, without suppressing democracy, include the pro-Soviet Tudeh Party, formerly a real menace, but now, the Times editors say, considered to have been completely liquidated, and the extreme nationalists who had been almost as subversive as the communists. And few people apparently find it jarring to read an upbeat report on what is called the return of full democracy in the Philippines, under the headline, "Aquino's Decree Bans Communist Party." And the last paragraph explains that a presidential decree stipulated penalties of imprisonment for membership in the party, which had been legalized under the Marcos dictatorship. Not long before, Marcos himself had been a model Democrat. He was a man pledged to democracy, as Ronald Reagan explained. "We love your adherence to democratic principle and to the democratic processes and your service to freedom," Vice President George Bush proclaimed in Manila. That, however, was before Marcos had lost control, and with it, his credentials as a freedom-loving Democrat. As we regularly discover, a solicitous concern for democracy and human rights may go hand in hand with tolerance for large-scale slaughter or even direct participation in it. The Christian Science Monitor observes accurately that after General Suharto's impressive achievement in eliminating the political threat in Indonesia by mass murder, many in the West were keen to cultivate Jakarta's new moderate leader, Suharto. In this reference, the term moderate is used with an appropriate casuistic interpretation. Suharto's subsequent achievements include extraordinary human rights violations at home and slaughter in the course of aggression in East Timor that bears comparison to Pol Pot in the same years. The Timorese slaughter was backed enthusiastically by the United States with the support of Canada, Britain, and other guardians of morality. The media cooperated by simply eliminating the issue. New York Times coverage declined as atrocities increased with U.S. participation. Times coverage reached zero at the peak of atrocities in 1978. And the few comments by its noted Southeast Asia correspondent Henry Kam assured us, on the authority of the Indonesian generals, that the army was protecting the people fleeing from the control of the guerrillas. Scrupulously excluded was the testimony of refugees, church officials, and others who might interfere with public acquiescence in what appears to be the largest massacre relative to the population since the Holocaust. In accordance with the same principles, it's natural that vast outrage should be evoked by the terror of the Pol Pot regime. While reporters in Phnom Penh in 1973, when the U.S. bombing of populated areas of rural Cambodia had reached its peak, should carefully ignore the testimony of hundreds of thousands of refugees before their eyes. Such selective perception guarantees that little is known about the scale and character of these U.S. atrocities. These achievements of historical engineering allow the editors of the New York Times to write that when America's eyes turned away from Indochina in 1975, Cambodia's misery had just begun, with the infamous barbarities of the Khmer Rouge, then dreary occupation by Vietnam, which incidentally expelled the Khmer Rouge. Notice that the misery began in 1975, not before, and they do not remind us that during the period of so-called indifference, Washington offered indirect support to the Khmer Rouge while backing the coalition, in which it was the major element because of its continuity with the Pol Pot regime, so the State Department declared. Today, the press explains, I'm quoting, that the U.S. and its allies have decided that without some sign of compromise by Vietnam toward a political settlement, the Khmer Rouge forces must be allowed to serve as military pressure on Vietnam, despite their past. The phrase political settlement, of course, means political settlement on U.S. terms. An appropriate casuistic interpretation of democracy solves only half the problem. We also need a phrase for the enemies of democracy in some country where we yearn to establish or maintain it. The reflex device is to label the indigenous enemy communists, whatever their social commitments and political allegiances may be. José Napoleón Duarte and his defense minister Vides Casanova are therefore Democrats in El Salvador, defending civilization against communists, such communists as the hundreds who were murdered by the security forces as they tried to flee to Honduras across the Rio Sumpul in May 1980. They were all communist guerrillas, Duarte explained, including presumably the infant sliced to pieces with machetes. The U.S. media took the simpler path of suppressing the massacre. If the enemies of democracy are not communists, then they're terrorists. Still better, communist terrorists, or terrorists supported by international communism. The rise and decline of international terrorism in the 1980s provides much insight into the utility of interpretations. The Reagan administration deserves the credit for focusing attention on what Ronald Reagan and George Shultz call the evil scourge of terrorism, a plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself in a return to barbarism in the modern age. From its first days, the Reagan administration proclaimed that international terrorism would replace Carter's human rights crusade as the soul of our foreign policy. By 1985, terrorism in the Mideast Mediterranean region was selected as the top story of the year in an AP poll of editors and broadcasters, and concern reached a fever pitch in subsequent months. The U.S. bombing of Libya in April 1986 largely tamed the monster, and in the following years, the plague subsided to more manageable proportions as the Soviet Union and its clients retreated in the face of American courage and determination. This is the story according to the preferred account. In fact, the rise and decline of the plague has little relation to anything happening in the world, with one exception. Its rise coincided with the need to mobilize the U.S. population to support the Reaganite commitment to state power and violence. Kremlin-directed international terrorism was a natural device for the Reaganite public relations apparatus. The problem was to frighten the domestic population sufficiently so that they would bear the costs of programs to which they were opposed, while at the same time avoiding direct confrontation with the evil empire itself. That's far too dangerous for us. The solution to the dilemma was to concoct an array of little Satans, tentacles of the great Satan, poised to destroy us, but weak and defenseless, so they can be attacked with impunity. The farce proceeded perfectly, with the cooperation of the casuists, whose task was to give a proper interpretation to the term terrorism, protecting the doctrine that its victims are primarily the democratic countries of the West. To conduct this campaign of ideological warfare, it was necessary to obscure the central role of the United States in organizing and directing state terror, and its extensive involvement in international terrorism in earlier years, as in the attack against Cuba, the prime example of the evil scourge of terrorism from the early 1960s. Some historical engineering was also required with regard to terrorism in the Middle East-Mediterranean region, the primary focus of concern within the propaganda framework. Here it was necessary to suppress the leading role of the United States and its Israeli client. These tasks were well within the capacity of the media and the terrorologists. With appropriate interpretations, then, we can rest content that the United States and its clients defend democracy, social reform, and self-determination against communists and terrorists of all kinds. It is the responsibility of the media to laud the Democrats and demonize the official enemy, the Sandinistas, the PLO, or whoever gets in the way. Sometimes this requires some fancy footwork, but the challenge has generally been successfully met.
The 1988 CBC Massey Lectures continue on ideas, presented by Noam Chomsky. Part 15, Peace, Democracy, and Freedom of the Press.
Our yearning for democracy is accompanied by a no less profound yearning for peace, and the media also face the task of historical engineering to establish this required truth. We therefore have phenomena called peace missions and the peace process. These are terms that apply to whatever the United States happens to be doing or advocating at some moment. A headline in the Los Angeles Times in January 1988 reads as follows, Latin Peace Trip by Schultz Planned. The subheading describes the contents of the peace trip. Mission would be last-ditch effort to defuse opposition on Contra aid. The article quotes administration officials who describe the peace mission as the only way to save Contra aid in the face of growing congressional opposition. In plain English, the peace mission is a last-ditch effort to block peace and to mobilize Congress for what the World Court called the unlawful use of force, now that Washington and its loyal media had succeeded in completely dismantling the unwanted Central American peace plan. A few months later, the New York Times reported further efforts by the administration, in their words, to keep pressure on the Sandinistas by continuing to provide support for the Contras, including more military aid, while urging U.S. allies to join the United States in efforts to isolate Nicaragua diplomatically and revive the peace process. The Los Angeles Times described these renewed administration efforts to build support for the resumption of U.S. military aid to Nicaragua's Contras under the headline, Schultz will try to revive Latin peace process. In short, war is peace. The task of historical engineering has been accomplished with no less efficiency in the case of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The problem has been to present the United States and its Israeli client as yearning for peace and pursuing the peace process, while in fact since the early 1970s, they have led the rejectionist camp and have been blocking peace initiatives that have had broad international and regional support. The technique has been the usual one. The peace process is, by definition, whatever the United States proposes. The desired conclusion now follows, whatever the facts. U.S. policy is also, by definition, moderate, so that those who oppose it are extremist and uncompromising. Reinhold Niebuhr once remarked that perhaps the most significant moral characteristic of a nation is its hypocrisy. The point is well taken. There's a simple measure of hypocrisy, which we very properly apply to our enemies. When peace groups, government figures, media, and loyal intellectuals in the Soviet sphere deplore brutal and repressive acts of the United States and its clients, we test their sincerity by asking what they say about their own responsibilities. Minimal honesty requires that we apply the same standards to ourselves. Freedom of the press, for example, is a prime concern for the media and the intellectual community. No crime of the Sandinistas has elicited more outrage than their censorship of La Prensa and its suspension in 1986, immediately after Congress responded to the World Court decision by voting new aid to the Contras, a virtual declaration of war, as the Reaganites happily proclaimed. La Prensa publisher Violeta Chamorro was at once given an award by the Nieman Journalism Foundation at Harvard for her courageous battle for freedom of speech. In the New York Review of Books, Murray Kempton appealed to all those committed to free expression to provide financial aid for the brave struggle of the editors to maintain their staff and equipment. Such gifts would supplement the funding provided by the U.S. government from shortly after the Sandinista victory, when President Carter authorized the CIA to secretly support La Prensa and the anti-Sandinista opposition. Under the heading, "A Newspaper of Valor," the Washington Post lauded Violeta Chamorro, commenting that she and her newspaper deserve 10 awards. Other media commentary has been no less effusive, while the Sandinistas have been bitterly condemned for harassing this tribune of the people. We now ask whether these sentiments reflect libertarian values or service to power, applying the standard test of sincerity. How, for example, did the same people and institutions react when the independent media in El Salvador were eliminated by the security forces of the Duarte government that we support? Not by intermittent censorship and suspension, but by murder, mutilation, and physical destruction. We have already seen the answer. There was silence. The New York Times has had nothing to say, and others are no different. To test this conclusion further, we may turn to Guatemala. No censorship was required while the United States was supporting the terror at its height. The murder of dozens of journalists sufficed. There was little notice in the United States. With the democratic renewal that we proudly hail, little has changed. In February 1988, the center-left weekly La Época began to publish Testing Guatemalan Democracy. On June 10th, 15 heavily armed men firebombed the offices, destroying them and kidnapping the night watchman. Eyewitness testimony and other sources leave little doubt that it was an operation of the Guatemalan security forces. The editor held a press conference on June the 14th to announce that the journal would have to shut down because there are not conditions in the country to guarantee the exercise of free and independent journalism. The next day he left the country, returning to exile, accompanied to the airport by a Western diplomat to see that he got there without being murdered. The destruction of La Época signaled not only the end of an independent media voice in Guatemala, but it served as a warning as well that future press independence would not be tolerated by the government or security forces, so the human rights group America's Watch commented. These facts were not reported in the New York Times or Washington Post, though not from ignorance, surely. It is simply that the matter is unimportant. A few weeks later, Israeli security forces raided the offices of the leading Jerusalem daily, Al-Fajr, arresting its managing editor, Hatem Abdel Kader, and jailing him for 6 months without trial on unspecified security grounds. There were no ringing editorial denunciations or calls for retribution. In fact, these trivialities were not even reported in the New York Times or Washington Post. Unlike Violeta Chamorro, to whom nothing of the sort has happened, Abdelkader does not deserve 10 awards, or even one, or even a line. The extent of the hypocrisy becomes still more obvious when we consider what the Washington Post called the newspaper of valor more closely. La Prensa quite openly supports the attack against Nicaragua. In April 1986, as the campaign to provide military aid to the Contras was heating up, one of the owners wrote an op-ed column in the Washington Post in which he called for aid to those Nicaraguans who are fighting for democracy. That's the standard reference to the U.S. proxy forces. In the weeks preceding the summer congressional vote, a host of articles by five different La Prensa staff members denounced the Sandinistas in major newspapers throughout the United States. This included a series of op-eds signed by top La Prensa editors in the Washington Post as they traveled to the United States under the auspices of front organizations of the contrafunding network run by Oliver North. La Prensa barely pretends to be a newspaper in the Western sense. It's a propaganda journal devoted to undermining the government and supporting the attack against Nicaragua by a foreign power. Since its reopening in October 1987, the commitments are quite open and transparent. There is no precedent for the survival and continued publication of such a journal during a period of crisis, to my knowledge, in any Western democracy, surely not the United States. It might be argued that comparison with the United States is inadequate and unfair, given the dismal U.S. record. We might take that to be the import of remarks by Supreme Court Justice William Brennan in a speech that he delivered at Hebrew University Law School in December 1987. In this speech, he observed that the United States has a long history of failing to preserve civil liberties when it perceived its national security threatened. He went on to say that it may well be Israel, not the United States, that provides the best hope for building a jurisprudence that can protect civil liberties against the demands of national security. And he added that the nations of the world, faced with sudden threats to their own security, will look to Israel's experience in handling its continuing security crisis, and they may well find in that experience the expertise to reject the security claims that Israel has exposed as baseless and the courage to preserve the civil liberties that Israel has preserved without detriment to its security. If we can draw lessons from Israel's stellar record, adversity may yet be the handmaiden of liberty, he concluded.